Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for this last week of September. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today I'll be talking with Paul Rubin. Paul is relatively new in town, and Paul is a wetlands biologist. Paul, let me ask you, just briefly, what's been your involvement with wetlands?
So I just recently moved here, like you spoke about. It's been about 4 months. I came from Florida.
That's a different world.
Yeah, it's about as opposite as it gets, and I'm happy to be here. I went to the University of Central Florida, where I studied biology, environmental sciences, and where I also started my career working with wetlands, wildlife, and a bunch of different environmental-related things. In terms of wetlands, I did wetland mitigation monitoring and also restoration. So after industries such as phosphate and sand mining industries go in and do what they do, a lot of the time they have to restore to the same function that that wetland once had. And we would go in, help restore it, and then annually monitor to continue non-native species coming in, making sure it was doing what it was supposed to.
So a wetland guy who's actually gotten his feet wet.
Yes.
That's great. Well, we'll come back and talk more about wetlands in just a few minutes, but first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, just a little bit of a hint. They are birds, yes. These birds are residents in our area all year long and are frequent visitors at bird feeders. In fact, just last week, one of them visited my front yard bird feeder. Other observations and news, and I'm going to ask Paul to help out with this. Of course, the first and most welcome bit of news is the return of the fall rains. And with the rains come salmon, and with the salmon come the resident killer whales. Some of the best salmon watching places locally are the mouth of Chimicum Creek, where it enters Port Townsend Bay on the just northern end of Irondale Beach County Park, the Jefferson Land Trust Illihee Preserve, that's sort of out towards Calla Point, and the Snow and Salmon Creek watersheds that are near the head of Discovery Bay. On the orca side, the Orca Network joyfully announced the return of large numbers of members of the J and L pod. Orca watchers had seen the pods throughout Puget Sound and northward into the waters around the San Juan Islands. Oh, hopefully those orca pods are finding enough salmon to feed this critically endangered clan.
On the subject of marine mammals, the Orca Network also reports that humpback whales are still coming into the Salish Sea, huge gatherings out west in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Some humpbacks in the Puget Sound, though fewer than in weeks past, and lovely trio traveling together down San Juan Channel.
I love whale watching. Well, fall also brings a host of migratory birds through our region. It's a great time for bird walks. And check out Birdcast. That's an online effort of the Cornell Ornithology Lab to bring regionally specific weekly forecasts of migrating birds. And for local sightings, remember the Admiralty Audubon's sightings webpage.
The folks at Stardate suggest we look up in the night sky this week to watch the eagles soar. The brightest is the star Vega, the swooping eagle, which is overhead at nightfall. Altair, the flying eagle, is in the southeast. The Eagle Nebula is a cloud of gas and dust that outlines a bird of prey with open wings.
And lastly, I want to share a photo that my friend Wendy Feltham posted on her iNaturalist page. Wendy always has lots of interesting sightings, but this one was an especially fun one. It was a photo of a very clear, trident-shaped footprint. It was of a great blue heron in the beach sand with a glowing white golf ball next to it. Someone must practice golf near this particular stretch of beach. Wendy often picks up golf balls along this stretch, along with other trash during her beach walks. That day, she happened to have a golf ball in her pocket, and it made a perfect indicator of the scale of the footprint. By the way, the great blue heron footprint was about 4 golf balls long and about 4 golf balls wide. I don't know of an easy transition, but let's go to wetlands. First of all, I guess, Paul, most of us have some notion of what a wetland is. I mean, it's almost self-explanatory. And some of us probably greet the notion of wetlands with great curiosities, and others, sometimes landowners who have development projects, have concern when they hear the word wetland applied to their property. From an ecological sense, tell me what actually is a wetland.
The Army Corps of Engineers, which regulates Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, they have the jurisdiction in a lot of cases around the country for wetlands. And they define it that they are areas that are inundated or saturated by surface or groundwater at a frequency and duration sufficient to support, and that under normal circumstances do support, a prevalence of vegetation typically adapted for life in saturated soil conditions. But a more practical kind of definition is a transitional ecosystem from an upland habitat, which is very dry, into a much wetter habitat, such as a pond, lake, river. But sometimes they do just occur without ever transitioning into something more wet. They can be the wettest of that area.
Okay, so it's neither terrestrial nor aquatic or marine. It's that in-between area.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you typically find plants that are adapted to that wet environment. What else?
Yeah, so the three major factors that a wetland is defined by really is its hydrology, its vegetation, and its soil. So hydrology can be coming from direct precipitation, from groundwater moving laterally, your water table.
Mm-hmm.
It can also be from flooding, which is not so frequent. It can also be from tidal forces. So salt marshes are a certain ecosystem that we'll talk more about, I'm sure, but coming in and out. That would be hydrology. Vegetation, we consider hydrophytes the term for vegetation that can survive in what we consider anoxic conditions, which are just kind of out of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much oxygen. These plants are able to tolerate these conditions that make it really difficult for most plants.
Wet and low oxygen.
Very low oxygen. They have special adaptations too. Some examples include buttressing. You see it in some trees. From Florida, we saw it in cypress trees. It's where you have a very wide base coming into a more narrow trunk.
Mm-hmm.
So they buttress out.
So that allows them structural support on
yes.
a squishy.
Yeah, very shallow root systems because
yeah.
there's less oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Another good example is what we call pneumatophores, which are oxygen breathing and root-like. So they're able to actually breathe in oxygen through what looks like roots.
So these would be plants that instead of taking the oxygen primarily through leaves, use a root system. Is that
yeah.
what you're saying?
Pneumatophores. Okay. They're yeah. root-like. We also have adventitious roots, which are a modified bark, and you'll see them trying to get away from the water. It's another structural technique for plants to survive in water.
Hmm.
That's mostly morphological. Physiologically, they grow in, just like we were talking about, very low oxygen type of soils. Reproductively, they're specialized in that they can disperse seeds by water.
Hmm.
They can usually persist a little bit longer than upland type plants. One good example that I love to talk about is cypress trees. A lot of people think that they can only grow in water, but they can actually grow perfectly fine on land. And this is in Florida and the southeast where I'm familiar with. But they would grow perfectly fine on land. The only difference is they can't reproduce out of water. So you'll see a cypress tree out of water. That's great. It'll look beautiful, but it's never going to reproduce without the help of its water dispersal of seeds.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, very cool. Just because this is a more local type thing, we do have a lot of wetlands here. Some common trees, shrubs, plants are Pacific willow. Most willow species are pretty wet. Pacific willow has a very linear leaf with serration. It's very lime green. Douglas spirea is another one. Very beautiful pink flowers kind of coming up the top. And then, you know, sluice edge is a very common one. You see it here and there. When it's dense, you know for a fact that it's probably going to be a wetland. Yeah, those are just common ones that I see a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's vegetation. For the last factor in soil, you have combinations of sand, silt, clay in all types of soil. So sand, and they all do different things, and they move water differently. So we call that capillary fringe. So sand has a higher ability to wick water up, just like osmosis, a capillary action, because it's bigger than silt and clay, and so it has more voids between
it. Yeah, the particles are bigger, yeah.
Yeah, so it can wick water up. So that's one little thing that can change soil completely. Clay is very small, and it's disc-shaped, and it actually is charged. So it makes a great hard pan. It holds water on top. It's a different thing, but soil, all these things are part of factors that create wetlands. Loams are another type of soil. And they're kind of a mixture of 40% sand, 40% silt, and 20% clay. Another important soil factor is what we call anaerobiosis, which is just microbial activity in soil. It tends to happen in areas above 40 degrees. It helps for saturated soils. So what the microbes do in saturated and in the perfect condition of you know, above 40 degrees is that they eat oxygen. And as they eat oxygen, oxygen will release electrons. And electrons will then combine to other molecules in the soil. Hydric soils will have sulfur, which you normally, you'll smell sulfur wet environment. Mm-hmm. Carbon, which you'll smell methane. These are that process of electrons coming in and changing the molecules into a hydric soil. One of the big references I use is iron will change from ferric, which is F. It's just a different type of iron into a ferrous iron, which is a reduced form when it adds an electron. And what is present in the soil is when you dig up soil, you'll see these little dots of orange. And that is that change. That is the microbial activity. And usually from the roots, as roots add oxygen into the soil, that system is happening.
Let me ask you another question. Oftentimes, if you're in our rainforest and looking at the streams, particularly as they're about to enter the ocean, so that where they've been through a lot of acreage of rainforest, they're orange or red or orangish brown or whatever. Now, is that tannin, or is that, or I don't even know what tannin is, or is that the iron, or what is that?
So the iron, a lot of the time you can smell it. It's usually in more stagnant water, and that is. I actually brought a data sheet, which is something I fill out every time I go to look at wetlands, and there's a category for that specific thing. I can't remember the name offhand, but yeah, a lot of the time, if it is stagnant water and you see like a very metallic-y looking, it looks like oil almost, that is a thing that you would consider, like you check off on a box and say, that's a wetland indicator. But tannins are usually what will kind of completely saturate the water from all the trees
that's the
going
breakdown,
through the river.
Yeah.
Yeah, so two different things, but they both have that kind of look to them.
Okay.
Kind of the difference between stagnant and moving water.
Okay, you talked a little bit about some of our local wetland plants, and I can see, and we've talked about the elements of what creates a wetland, but there must be many different kinds of wetlands. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and then kind of bring it home to the, you know, our neck of the Pacific Northwest, what kind of wetlands we have around here?
Yeah. So most common wetlands include marshes, which are freshwater, non-woody type plants inhabiting them. So there's no trees.
Mm-hmm.
Another common one is the exact opposite. So you have swamps, which are freshwater, but they are very woody. They can have all types of plants, including trees. You have a fen, which is, the water table is near the surface almost year-round, but more regularly than not. You have wet prairies, which are a lot like marshes, but there's a lot of grasses present, and it's wet. You have tidal marshes, which besides marshes are salt-tolerant. So you have tidal force, and there's salt water included in the water. One real local one is Kai Tai Lagoon, which is right down the road from here, and that's a shallow body of water, which is separated by something from a larger body of water. Peat, with abundant organic matter, and that matter builds up quicker than it can be decomposed.
So that's where you get the peat bogs, and you get that kind of spongy, bouncy feel as you walk over it.
Yeah, exactly. And then you also have bogs, which usually occur from precipitation.
Okay.
As far as local and kind of these types of environments that happen around here, a lot of our wetlands around here can be factors from rivers and just your normal set of conditions, but also because of glacial retreat and the constant pounding from glaciers over a long time and creating very hard pan depressions and impermeable surfaces, which then collect water.
So, Paul, there's a lot of effort and attention paid to wetlands and wetland conservation, wetland mitigation, wetland rehabilitation. Why are they so significant ecologically, and why are they important to humans? I guess the kind of question is, what's the fuss all about? And that, I know, will bring us into the concept of ecosystem services, and which is a sort of a relatively modern ecological concept. And I'm going to read a definition, and this is from the UN's 2006 Millennium Ecosystem Assessment that defines ecosystem services as the benefits people obtain from ecosystems. Okay. And then they also suggest there are four categories of ecosystem services: supporting, provisioning, regulating, and cultural. So why all the fuss about wetlands?
I think the first thing that comes to most people's minds as far as wetlands and the services they provide, they're one huge filter. We care a lot about rivers. We care a lot about the ocean. But what it's kind of that buffer area between where a lot of your pollutants and your fertilizers or really just about anything can sequester inside of them. And a lot of the time they do filter. You'll see wastewater treatment facilities kind of acting as that artificial factor.
So that's the whole notion of water quality.
Yes.
Maintaining water quality naturally.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think, the most obvious. Nitrogen's a big one too. And a lot of the time you'll see cattail as a common, at least in Florida. I haven't been to the one. There's one in Port Townsend right here. There's actually a few in this area: Seattle, Linwood, Anacortes has all treatment facilities, water treatment facilities. At least I've seen cattail is a common one, which does suck up that nitrogen and it turns it from a usable biological form into a gas, and it releases it back in the atmosphere a lot quicker. So as far as what else does it do, that's the obvious, right? I think swamps and marshes are actually some of the most productive ecosystems on the entire earth. They rival even rainforests and cultivated lands. But except, unlike cultivated lands, there's no input. They're actually just completely self-sufficient. They don't require the inputs of fertilizer. And most of that production, though, goes to decomposers. A lot of the decomposition is happening. There's really not too many primary consumers or secondary consumers.
But we do think about it also as nursery areas.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, one thing they do is, as far as getting habitat for animals, rookeries are a common thing. Basically, wading birds require a certain amount of habitat to reproduce in rookeries.
I think if I would sort of think about other things, you could probably make a long list of issues like flood control, protection from storms, which we've seen impacts of that recently. And I've also read, and I'm just going to ask you if you agree with this, that if you look at the sort of economic value of the various collective ecosystem services that wetlands provide, that often far exceeds the economic value of that land changed out of wetlands into some what humans might call productive land use. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, I do. Wherever I go, when I see wetlands, I do see a higher diversity of animals. I see generally not in areas that don't seem so flooded, or it seems like they do provide a serviceable function that we don't really, or we commonly overlook. A few others that come off mind, they do a good job of storing carbon. Climate change is something we think about as being a pretty hot topic.
Yeah.
They do a lot, in especially peatlands. I've got 5 billion metric tons of carbon being stored there alone. And so, you know, you could see that as being a pretty serviceable factor.
Yeah. So we're getting close to the end of our time. What I'd like you to do is to share with me cool story about one of your experiences in wetlands, or one of your sort of favorite wildlife sightings, or just share a cool story.
Yeah, I'd love to. About a year ago, I was in the Everglades, and I was rushing on time. Everyone was separated in my group of friends, and who we were doing these jobs. But basically, I did threatened and endangered species surveys out in the middle of swamps in the Everglades, or near the Everglades. And there was a day, it was getting late, and I realized that I needed to be at a pickup point at a certain time, and I was kind of running behind schedule. And so I kind of booked it to that area. And the entire time, I got to climb over logs, falling over, and kind of just completely within this huge swamp. And just even taking a second was just to see all this diversity, orchids. You know, you see lots of orchids over there, and you see a lot of things like that. And I get the same feeling here. When I walk through creeks and I walk through wetlands here, you're in water up to your knees, and you feel so kind of away from everything for a second. It's usually a pretty conserved area, so you're away from traffic, you're away from, you know, the hustle and bustle, and for even just a moment, you get to see a cool bird, or you see a river otter, or you see a mink maybe, or you know, you see red-winged blackbirds nesting, or great blue herons are kind of a pretty common one here. But in times like that, when you really just get to be amongst it, I think is the most beautiful moments I get to have in wetlands. And I encourage everyone to go out and put on those wading boots and experience it for themselves.
Get your feet wet. It sounds, in a way, almost spiritual. Whoa, Paul, this has been really interesting. I think we're nearing the end of our time. And I want to share with our listeners something very, very special. Paul is going to join our Nature Now team. So you'll be hearing more of Paul in future months as he sits on the other side of this interview table and talks to folks about things of interest to Nature Now. So welcome to the team, Paul.
Thank you. I'm very excited. I can't wait to be on the other side and coming up with the questions.
Well, thanks a bunch, Paul, and we'll enjoy working with you. We need to hear that mystery sound again, and I want you to pay a special attention to the details of this sound because I'm going to give you a little tiny test in a minute. Well, that was the pick, whinny, and drumming sounds of a downy woodpecker. The downy woodpecker's whinnying call, and it's made by both sexes. It's typical in the deciduous forest during breeding seasons. And it's a somewhat, I guess I would describe it as a string of hoarse, kind of high-pitched sounds. And you can hear that they descend in pitch towards the end of that call. A call lasts 2 seconds or so. Excited birds give that sharp pick tone, occasionally repeated several times. Downies are very common around and near bird feeders. I'd say they can be found on almost any kind of feeder, a suet feeder, black sunflower seeds, millet, peanuts, whatever. And then a challenge to beginning birders is to learn to distinguish between the downy woodpecker and its similar but larger cousin, the hairy woodpecker. There are a lot of visual clues. Of course, the downy is very small compared to its relative woodpeckers. But their calls are also slightly different. So I want to play the sounds of a hairy woodpecker for you. See if you can distinguish some of the differences and similarities. Well, perhaps you heard. The most common call of the hairy woodpecker is instead of the pick, pick, pick of the downy, it's more like a peek. It's similar, but it's a little lower pitched. Maybe think lower pitch, larger bird. And it's somewhat more emphatic. In the whinny or the rattle, the hairy woodpeckers do make that similar sound to the downies, but it doesn't descend at the end. It stays pretty much at the same pitch. And frankly, I have to admit, when you listen to the drumming sounds, I can't tell the difference. Can you, Paul?
It's the pitch. It's a much higher pitch for a downy woodpecker, and their bills are much smaller. Mm-hmm. They're very small. Whereas a hairy woodpecker, it's a little bit bigger. It's usually that's how I can
see sort of the robustness of the...
Yeah, the size of the bill and the pitch of the call.
Well, and we want to give thanks to the Cornell Ornithology Lab's Macaulay Library for the sound recordings. Looking forward, what's coming up around here? There are lots of fun natural history outings happening. Paul, will you help me share some of these?
The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is putting on a special event, the Dungeness River Festival, on Friday, September 29th at the Railroad Bridge Park. There will be fun, entertainment, and fry bread.
Okay.
Salmon walks, fish printing, and interactive exhibits and displays for all ages. And then on Saturday, September 30th, the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is offering a morning field trip to explore shorebirds and to try to figure out what they are. Details for both events can be found on the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society webpage.
And the Jefferson Land Trust invites everyone to attend a fun-filled, family-friendly Chimicum Creek picnic on Saturday, September 30th at the Illihee Preserve. Bring your picnic lunch and blanket and come out to celebrate the plants and animals and people that make Chimicum Creek special. There'll be activities for everyone to enjoy, salmon viewing, fun nature viewing activities, discussions and identification on wild edibles and on Northwest native plants. There'll be crafts for kids and even experiences to try to figure out what the birds are communicating. Check the Jefferson Land Trust website for details.
It certainly promises to be an exciting fall. The Port Townsend Marine Science Center begins its lecture series on Sunday, October 8th, with a talk on the sonic world of the Amazonian pink dolphin. The Washington State University Extension Service's Stream Stewards class is also beginning, and many of our local natural history groups are offering field trips and talks.
So, is going to be a lot going on. Check those websites. Well, that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information from the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. You can email us at naturenow, that's one word, naturenow at kptz.org. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Wetlands, performed by Paul Spring.
Maybe I should just be grateful for the glow in the clouds out there, seeping up in pale yellows from a city nearby. For if it were any darker, I'd lose track of your steps, walking out into the wetlands from the edge of this town. On either side of this dotted line, semblance of an order, street lights held in cement, they bloom on the horizon with a flickering scent. I look over my shoulder, sunken eyes.